Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy podcast is provided by DSL Extreme. Call 866-2-GET-NET or DSL Extreme. Hi, this is Leo, and this is the Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Networks on Saturday, May 5th, 2007. This is show 349. Very good day to you, and hello everybody across the geek world. I am Leo Laporte, and this is the show where we talk about tech. And oh, is there a lot to talk about today? Technology, everything to do with computers, the internet, and all those gadgets you've got, like the cell phones and the camcorders, the digital cameras, the MP3 players. And home theater, your television, your DVD player. I mean, it's all technology nowadays. What an amazing world, whether it's entertainment, work, play, school, your church, your family. We're all using technology like crazy. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. I'd love to hear from you. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's 888-827-5536. We've got a chat room going. About 100 people in there right now. There'll probably be another 50 or 60 in there before the day's over at irc.dslextreme.com. irc.dslextreme.com. Also, of course, a website. And the show notes going to be a little slow today because Shuby's got AP exams. America's favorite high school sophomore is busy. Not going to be able to take the show notes, so I'm going to try to do it while I'm talking. That'll be interesting. You can read the results at techguylabs.com. I'll try to get everything in there. If not during the show, at least before the show's too old. too long in the tooth. This is episode 349. Well, it was an interesting day an interesting week for copy protection. And in some ways, I think what we saw was the beginning of the end of DRM, digital rights management, they call it. Copy restrictions, some call it. The idea that you buy a DVD, for instance, but you can't make a copy of it, whether for yourself or for others. You can't put it on your hard drive. You can't. It's got copy protection on it. Now, of course, everybody who listens to this show by now knows that you can easily copy a DVD to your hard drive. There's plenty of software out there to do that, free software. The Motion Picture Association tries to put it out of business. Every company that does this, but others spring up, and frankly, I think they've given up now. The problem was that very early on in the life of the DVD, only one or two years in, Linux enthusiasts said, well, wait a minute, because of this copy protection, because we have to use a program licensed by the Motion Picture Association of America, we can't play movies on Linux because it's open source, and they won't let us make an open source player. We don't like that. We want to play movies on our Linux. So a guy named Jan Johansson, he was actually a high school kid in Norway, right? Norway, I think, yeah. Scandinavian high school kid. Said, well, this can't be that complicated. And figured out how to crack it. Something called DECSS. CSS is the copy protection on DVDs. Put the word out. For a long time, there was an attempt to keep it, you know, to silence it. At the time, the Motion Picture Association of America and others said, well, you know, they sued, they went to court, they fought, they tried, they prosecuted Jan Johansson, who is, unfortunately, because he's a Norwegian national, was completely immune. The Norwegian courts threw it out. I said, no, what are you talking about? And people would put the CSS code on a T-shirt. they put it everywhere. And as hard as the Motion Picture Association of America tried to stop the code from escaping, it not only escaped, it grew. In some ways, you might say that their attempts to shut it down helped spread it. And as a result, for the last, whatever it is, 8 years, it's been easy to make copies of DVDs. And the software exists, widespread, easily used, easily available, free software to make a copy of your DVD. Motion Picture Association America said, well, that didn't work. But we've got this new format coming out. We got it, high-def formats. We've got Blu-ray and HD DVD. Boy, we're not gonna make the same mistake twice. No siree. So what they do, they made the same mistake twice. They did the same thing. But wait, no, this is a better copy protection scheme. No one will ever crack this. This AACS, oh, boy, is this good. This is so much better than the old CSS. Oh, AACS, the Advanced Access Content System, can't be cracked by anybody. HD DVD came out in a week. Within a week, the first crack started coming out. And more and more. You know, I guess, that's too bad. It seems like it was cracked almost right away. But the Motion Picture Association of America, not having learned from CSS, or maybe, you know, from their point of view, having learned from CSS, said, well, we better put the lid on this, clamp this one down. So they have some ways of changing these things. What happens is that every device that can play back a high-def disc has a key unique to it. And that key can be revoked. So once the keys start to leak out, they revoke them. They actually force you, and this has happened already, with one PC program to play high-def DVDs. Was it WinDVD? They revoked the keys. They a mandatory update. You've got to change the software. The current key won't work anymore because they'd been cracked. Well, hackers, of course, have come up with keyless ways to do this, ways around it, so forth. There are literally commercial programs out there that'll do this. But the revolt kind of hit the streets this week on May Day on a site called dig.com. You may know this site. If you're a geek, you certainly know this site. It's a public news site where the idea is, instead of a site like the New York Times where you have an editor choosing stories and putting them up on the front page, the readers choose the stories and they vote on them, and the most popular stories get to the front page. And so somebody posted on Dig a long prime number that was the key, the new key, to decrypt these disks. A really long prime number. I could read it to you, in fact. And the irony of this is, it was first posted in Cory Doctorow teaches a course in these subjects. And somebody was blogging about his course, and it was always initially on Google's Blogger platform. And the AACS folks sent what's called a demand letter to Google saying, pull those sites down. Google did. Google complied. But this number still got out. And so somebody posted on dig.com. And of course, the AACS folks sent the same demand letter to dig.com. And Dig, as you know, is pretty typical on sites like this, pulled it down. And somebody else posted it again and again. People started creating accounts to post it again. Diggs pulled them down, banned the new accounts. People posted again and again and again. Now, if Dig had done what Cory Doctorow did, maybe this one would have gone away. Cory Doctorow pulled it down, pulled that special secret number down. By the way, the number by itself is useless. You still have to have the software and a considerable amount of skill to use it. So Cory Doctorow, who is a advocate against DRM, copy protection, pulled it down, but what he did is he replaced it with the demand letter saying pull it down, because the demand letter contained the number. It had to, because it had to specify what it is to pull down. So that's quite clever. So the number is still on his site, this time in a letter, demand letter from AACS. Anyway, Dig pulled it down, and more diggers pushed it up. Pretty soon, the entire front page of Dig is this number in a variety of forms. A revolt on the internet, 15,000 people, or more maybe, posting this number. Impossible to stop. What's Dig going to do? If they're afraid if they don't pull it down, they'll get sued. But it's clear that their users, who are very vocal, are saying, hey, you know, you got to leave this up. Now, the founder of Dig, who's a good friend, Kevin Rose, kind of made his name as the dark tipper, as the, you know, the guy who showed you how to do this stuff. So it must have been kind of hard for the dark tipper to pull this stuff down. Finally, he gave up. He said, hey, I may lose the company. I suppose I could be sued to death over this. But I can't. But you're voting with your posts. I can't stop you. And it's clear you want me to let this stuff sit up there. So I'm going to do it. And he posts it. He says, I'm not going to pull him down anymore. You know, the interesting thing is immediately after he said that, all the posts went away. It just shows you the more you fight this stuff, the more it comes out, right? That's what I mean by repeating the mistakes of CSS and DCSS, the Motion Picture Association, the AACS folks, really just kind of did the same thing. They fought it and discovered, again, 10 years later, you can't. There are too many consumers and too few of you. Now, the question is, are we advocating piracy here? No, I don't think so. I think really this is a vote. First of all, as Cory Doctorow has pointed out, more people know this number than have high-def DVD players. And certainly far more have this number than know how to what to do with it. It's a statement. It's not about the number. It's a statement that we don't want copy protection anymore. I've been done a lot of interviews on this subject, and the reporters keep saying, well, what do you replace this with if it's broken? You don't replace it. You don't replace it. Copy protection doesn't work. I think that's proven. Do people still make money on DVDs despite the fact that they're easily copied? Yeah, as a matter of fact, they do. A lot of money. A lot of money. It's a very, very successful format. Maybe if they just remove the copy protection, that would be the thing the HD, DVD, and Blu-ray need to kick it forward. If one of them, if just one of them said, okay, we won't do copy protection, it'd kill the other one. Because that's what consumers want. They want the ability to put it on their hard drive. You know, high-def discs are huge. I don't think there's going to be a lot of piracy of high-def discs. They're gigantic. It's not about piracy. It's not about putting them on the internet. It's about the right to copy something you bought and owned. And I think that that's not an unreasonable thing to ask. Interesting internet. Rebellion, if you will. But enough of that. Let's talk to you. 8888-ASK-LEO. I'd like to hear what's on your mind. Let's talk high tech. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Talking to high tech, 8888, Ask Leo. I really shouldn't spend so much time on this dig story because there's so many other important stories like internet radio getting a reprieve. And we'll talk about all of them. And of course, you know, mostly I want to talk to you. Let's get right to the phones and see what's on your mind. 8888, Ask Leo. Brian is in Fairfax, Virginia, our first caller today. Hello, Brian.
Hello there. I miss you from the tech TV days.
Ah, the good old days. Yeah, I hear that a lot. It's funny, and it's been more than 2 years now.
But it was the best example of what cable TV should be.
Yeah. Apparently, that might be the case, except that the cable companies didn't think so. So, there
yeah.
you go.
Well, that's life. That's anyway, life. I'm trying to figure out two transitions right now, simultaneously, believe it or not. The first is when to go to Vista or not to go
yeah.
to Vista at all.
Okay.
And the second is, I had my Palm TX glitch on me.
Oh, dear.
And, you know, I was manually inputting a calendar item, and all of a sudden, anything that wasn't a repeat function, repeat event, disappeared.
Oh, boy.
But not from the desktop.
Thank goodness.
I tried doing a hard reset, amongst other things.
Yeah.
Didn't cure it.
Really?
Apparently, there's something that's gotten sucked into the desktop info, and I'm willing, if I have to transfer to an entirely new device, but I've looked at the Windows Mobile smartphones, and those have maybe 35 megabytes of RAM. I tried an HP iPack, a high-end one, and it doesn't seem to get much better because once you start putting the calendar info in, and I've been doing it manually, that sucks up a hell of a lot of the RAM, even if you put all of your programs on the storage card.
Right.
So I'm trying to figure out where to go.
Well, let's start with a Vista one, because I think that's pretty quick. And the answer in that is I don't think most people should be upgrading to Vista. If you're buying a new machine, I mean right now, if you're buying a new machine and it's going to come with Vista, that's fine. But the issues that people are facing with Vista are compatibility with existing hardware compatibility with existing software, both of which aren't great, and that's to be expected. Vista's a big step forward, and it's really the security features of Vista that seem to be causing the most problems. In 6 months, I think it would be time to reevaluate, maybe even sooner, this fall, let's say. It'd be time to reevaluate, because by then many of these problems will be worked out. People will have up. I mean, look, if you're making software for Windows, you darn well better make sure it works with Vista. Same thing with hardware. So unless these companies
I made sure to get both the original restore disks for the machine as well as the free upgrade disks.
So I'd say if XP is working fine for you and you're keeping it secure and you know how to do that, and that's kind of a big and, because, you know,
Norton 360.
Yeah. A lot of, I'm not crazy about Norton 360, but if it's working for you, again, I guess my answer is, if what you've got is working reliably and you're okay with it, I wouldn't recommend upgrading yet, because people are having so many problems. Some people upgrade fine. Okay. I've upgraded a number of machines, no problem, but the compatibility issues are what you're going to run into, and those should be gone in 6 months, or at least it'll be time to reevaluate. I do think Vista is an improvement. Now, as for the data, it does sound like your data is corrupted, and that's because if you've reset the Palm hard reset and it's erased all the data, the one where you press the up down thing and and everything's gone. It's as if it came from the factory, and you sync it, and that same problem comes back. Clearly, it's in the desktop data now too. What you might want to try is exporting the desktop data out into a text format, as if you're going to be moving to a different product, deleting all the data in the desktop. And by the way, I'd back this up before you do anything, but deleting all the data in the desktop and then re-importing it. And what I'm hoping is that the issue you're having is an issue kind of in the binary data, but if you export it out as text, it'll all be imported back kind of normally.
Right. The problem is I can do that easily with the contacts or the tasks and the memos when I've done that, but how do you do it with the calendar data?
It does not export calendar data?
Not that I can find.
I haven't used the Palm desktop in a while, so I don't remember if there's a hidden switch in there. Gosh, you'd sure think it'd export the calendar data. What good is it if it doesn't?
Yeah.
That would be my recommendation, is see if you can get it out of the desktop in a form that is less likely to be corruptible. In other words, in a text form. And then you might want to search, if it's still happening, and you might want to search through that data and see if you can see where the problem lies. I have to say, this is kind of endemic to all platforms, this corruption of data. And syncing, I think, is what does it. And these platforms are not as robust as they ought to be. I have the same problem with other stuff. I'm not sure what I'd recommend as a replacement, because I don't know if there's anything that's going to never have these problems.
Well, I'm not worried about never having the problem. What I'm worried about is having enough room to actually for it to be useful.
Right.
And it seems like Mr. Gates has done the 640K dance again.
I don't like Windows Mobile particularly. You might look at a Trio P instead of a W. Then you'll get another Palm device. Are you set against Palm now? Is that it? You want to get rid of
it? No, it's not that I'm set against Palm. I seriously considered going to the Windows, the Palm smartphones, but then I found out that they are totally incompatible with any hands-free device not made by Palm.
Oh, isn't that nice? You know, I have to say, I'm not a fan of Windows Mobile 5. Windows Mobile 6 might be better, but I've never been much of a fan of Pocket PC, Windows CE, or Windows Mobile. I think that it's overkill. It's too big. It's, you know, why I don't want so many clicks just to do one simple thing. And that kind of bugs me. I like the Palm operating system. I like the Symbian operating system. If you're looking at a smartphone, I think the Symbian operating system is pretty good and does give you a lot more memory. My Nokia N95 has 130 megs of internal RAM and comes with a gigabyte card. Now, they're expensive because no phone company is subsidizing it right now. And it's been great in terms of syncing calendar and other data. Not sure what to say. Coming up, Home Theater with Scott Wilkinson, Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy.
Kelly on the board, the tech guy from the beautiful Tech Guy Labs in Northern California, and joining us now, as he does almost every week, to talk about technology and security. Mr. Steve Gibson, the creator of Shields Up. Hey, Steve, Securable, all those great programs at GRC.com. And, of course, SpinRite, which is a fantastic hard drive recovery and maintenance program. We talked on the podcast this week on Security Now about something called multi-factor authentication.
It's, you know, the people who think about security a lot have come up sort of with like the theory of how people prove who they are on the internet. And the normal way, the simple way, the way that I'm sure everyone is now familiar with, who's certainly listening to your show, Leo, and who is using computers who are on computers which are on the internet, is just the use of a username and a password. You know, that's from time immemorial. That's the way people have logged on to, you know, their banking sites, the New York Times website to read the news, or, you know, whatever. It's typical, you know, type in your username or password. And certainly e-commerce sites, Amazon works that way, and eBay and so forth.
You know, Bill Gates said something about passwords. It wasn't even very long ago, a few months ago. He said that that's about the worst way you could do it.
Well, yes. And in fact, Microsoft has an initiative with Vista to begin to move people away from what's called single factor authentication.
What's wrong with that?
Well, the problem is passwords are well, the good news is they're free, but you get what you pay for. So, which is to say, not that much. The problem is that if passwords are easy to remember, it's probably because they're simple. What if they're simple? They can be guessed. And of course, how many movies have revolved around the idea that, you know, it's your kid's birthday, it's your spouse's birthday, it's where, you know, what state you were born in, or, well, whatever.
And conversely, if they're not simple, then your tendency would be to write it down and put it on a Post-it note on the screen. And I've seen people do this all the time. Or you remember in War Games, the teacher had it on a pull-out drawer written down so that they would remember it. Or you put it in your wallet, and that makes it insecure too, even if it's a good password.
Exactly. Or, of course, the other advice is have multiple passwords. That is, use different passwords for different services. That way, if one of them is compromised, that doesn't compromise the other passwords, which you're also using. But
who can remember all those passwords?
Exactly.
Actually,
exactly.
I use, and we'll talk about it later on the show, two programs that I love, RoboForm AI for Windows and 1Password for the Mac, which keep track of them. They generate them. They make good passwords. It's a good solution. But you still have that fundamental issue. If anybody gets that file and can unencrypt it or figure out what your single password that locks the file is, they've got all your passwords.
Yeah, exactly. It's the mother load.
Right. So the best way is to have two ways or more ways to authenticate yourself.
Well, yes. And before we leave passwords, the problem is you either have deliberate divulgence of the password where you give it to someone. Now they're able to pretend to be you, and there's essentially no way to know that it's not. And of course, passwords can easily be captured in online transactions, which is really bad. For example, if you had a keystroke logger which is watching someone type their password if it's this single factor and it's something you know, it's possible for someone else to know it, whether inadvertently or deliberately, and at that point, you've lost your authentication. So anything based on just a password is called single-factor authentication.
Not so bad for, you know, reading the New York Times online, but not great for your bank.
Exactly. And in fact, so the idea is that what we're moving towards on the internet is called multi-factor authentication, where multi-factor authentication being something more than just a password. Now, we can sort of generalize this whole notion of authentication. A password is something you know. Other factors could be something you have or something you are.
Okay, wait a minute. Let me get this right. Password, something you know.
Yep.
Like the password or a PIN.
Exactly.
But the other thing could be something you have Or
and
something
the third
you are.
Could be something you are.
So, give me an example. What's something you have?
A perfect example of something you have is, which many people are familiar with, is an ATM card.
Oh, okay.
So,
sure.
So when you want to get cash out of an ATM machine, you have to be in physical, have physical ownership of the card.
Something you have. And you need a PIN, something you know. So that's dual fact. That's two things, dual factor authentication.
Exactly. Two factor authentication. Beauty is, you know, your kids can't sneak your ATM card out and use it as long as you weren't dumb enough to write the PIN number on the card.
I don't want to tell you what my wife's PIN number is, but let me put it this way. It's one of our kids' names. Not good.
Yeah, not good. Especially now that you've told everyone.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Really not good. But the first thing you'd guess, right?
Exactly. Is you start trying those things. So, but the concept is that by requiring something you have, this is a much stronger system.
Sure.
Because, for example, it can't be captured electronically. There's no way to capture somebody's ATM card through the internet. It's something physical.
You need the card, yeah.
That they actually have to be in possession of.
And you need the PIN.
Yes, and it also, it can't be readily, you know, duplicated. A password, you can write it down, you can mail it to your friends. You know, it's inherently multiplicable, if that's a word. But you know what I mean. Whereas an ATM card, there's only one of them, and it's always going to be somewhere at some time, hopefully under your own control.
Right.
And, of course, the last thing, something you are, is arguably the strongest authentication, because something you are is like your fingerprint or your eyeball's retinal pattern.
You're seeing that a lot
now.
Can
be scanned.
Yeah, in fact, I see laptops and PDAs with thumbprint recognizers on them.
Yeah, and I think those are actually very robust ways of authenticating. I would like, if I'm carrying a laptop around, for it to do nothing when I turn it on until I drag my finger across it to prove that it's me who has this laptop and not some bad guy.
So that's where we're going now, is with kind of multi-factor authentication.
Yes, I think there's no choice. You know, it's an annoyance for users because they have to, maybe they have like a little dongle on their key ring, which is continuously providing them with a 6-digit number that they have to enter, and that number changes every minute. Well, that's not zero expense, but it's a lot more strong than just a password, because only somebody who is right now in possession of that little token is able to know what 6-digit number it's got on its screen.
Right. Makes perfect sense. It's fascinating, really. You can study this in school. This is a topic that is currently very hot.
Right.
And rightly so, because we all need more security.
And I think what's going to happen to everyone listening to this, over time, some sort of multi-factor authentication is going to become more and more commonplace, because the need to know who's at the other end of an internet connection, you know, whether you're banking or buying or whatever you're doing, or maybe in the future voting, that's going to be increasingly important.
Good point. Steve Gibson is a security guru who does a podcast with me every week on the Twit Network, twit.tv. It's called Security Now. We talk, in fact, on the most recent Security Now, episode 90, about this in great detail. And, of course, you can catch his work on his website, grc.com. That's where he's got all those great free security applications. And SpinRite, which is, as you've heard me say many times on the show, the disk recovery and maintenance utility. It's a miracle drug for your broken disks, so to speak. Steve, great to talk to you.
Thanks, Leo.
Let's get back to the phones. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy, and Audrey's on the line from Fontana, California. Hello, Audrey.
Hi, Leo. Listen, love your show.
Thank you.
Catch it every weekend whenever you get a chance.
Oh, I'm so glad.
My question basically is, I'm looking into a wireless keyboard. I know they don't have the split board anymore. It's more contoured to the hand.
You like the split board, huh?
Yeah, I like that. It's kind of natural for my fingers because I type a lot.
Yeah.
But I don't want to spend $200 on a keyboard. That's like a third of the price of my computer, you know?
I don't blame you. my favorite, there are two ways you could do wireless nowadays. One is with RF, radio frequency, and the other is with Bluetooth, because a lot of computers now have Bluetooth. I find wireless frequency better than Bluetooth. I don't really recommend the Bluetooth. There seems to be a slight delay. My favorite cordless keyboard, wireless keyboard, is the Logitech. Actually, they make a number of them. They don't make a split one, as you said. They make a swoopy-doopy one that's kind of got that ergonomic. It's called the Comfort keyboard.
Uh-huh.
Cordless Comfort. But they make about seven or eight. The Denovo is really nice, really beautiful. It's got a separate keypad. But I would look at the Logitechs. In my opinion, they make the best wireless keyboards.
Super, super. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call. Keep listening. Let's see here. I want to go to the next caller, who would be Bob in Lafayette, California, listening. Where are you listening, on the internet?
Yes, I am.
Well, great. Thanks for joining us. What can I do for you?
I've got hours and hours of old family tapes recorded on VHS. Remember carrying around those 10-pound recorders?
Oh, yeah.
Hard to believe, but I just assumed I'd be transferring them using one of those Dazzle, I think, or something into my computer. But it occurred to me it might be a lot simpler just to sort of preserve them without editing, to buy one of those combined VHS-DVD recorders.
It is.
Just pop the tape in and record it. But I'm wondering about the quality of those.
It's exactly the same quality. It's going to convert it to MPEG-2, which is a DVD format. That's as good as or better. If a good quality input is better than the VHS. But it'll certainly be good enough to record the VHS. It's not going to degrade it, let's put it that way. And they make it very easy. They even allow you to do chaptering and even some simple editing. So I think that's actually, if you're doing more than a handful of these, much easier than putting it into the computer.
Yeah, it just occurred to me. It was like this revelation.
Yeah, and then you get a DVD recorder, which they work kind of like TiVos. It becomes your VCR onto DVD, and I think they're very good. Panasonic makes a very good one. I don't own one of these. I've played with them. I reviewed them. But I haven't reviewed them lately, but in talking to others who own them, they seem to like the Panasonic. I'd look on Amazon.com at the reviews before you buy, but I think that's a very good idea. Great way to dub VHS tapes. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. More of your calls coming up. The Tech Guy. 8888 Ask Leo is the number if you want to talk about tech. 8888 Ask Leo. I said our AV guy, Scott Wilkinson, would be on. He's actually on next hour. I'm sorry, I got that confused. Scott and Steve got confused. Well, I got confused. They aren't confused. They know exactly when they're on. So we'll get Scott Wilkinson on next hour to talk about. I think he's going to talk about HD DVDs. And the Gizwiz, Dick DiBartolo, coming up, too. That's going to be fun. It's going to be a great show. Meanwhile, let's say hello to David, who is listening in, it looks like, Mebane, North Carolina. Am I saying that right? Mebane?
Mebane is close, yeah.
Mebane. Hey,
how are you doing, Leo?
Great, David. Thanks for calling us.
You know, it's funny. I started watching you on a postage stamp-sized real player window about 10 years ago on ZDTV.
Oh, wow.
And technology has really improved now. I can watch you on a Ustream window that is double the size of a postage stamp now.
Yeah. So, I've been playing with this for the last few weeks, and I haven't really publicized it too much because I'm afraid that the company will not be able to handle the bandwidth demand, but I am streaming.
Let the cat out of the bag.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's okay. I don't mind. I'm streaming a live video of the kind of the labs as I sit here. I can't imagine anything more boring than watching a guy do a radio show. But anyway, you can watch. And it's at twit.tv/live is where I've put the picture. It's coming from Ustream, which is a neat idea. I mean, this Ustream.tv, it's very simple. It uses Flash. So if you've got any webcam that works with your computer, and every computer supports Flash, it's very easy to get this thing working. And it seems to do a pretty good job as long as a million people don't try to watch it at the same time.
Right. That's kind of fun just to watch the inner workings of the show there.
Watch me eat soup during the commercials. What fun.
Right.
How fascinating can that be?
That is just great.
Dave, maybe I can help you. Maybe I can make up for this by helping you with something.
I hope so. I've got a tale of woe to tell you. My computer gets filthy. It sits on the floor in our house on a carpeted living room. Mm-hmm. So I open it up and take it outside now and then and blow it out with compressed air.
That's a good idea.
Dust goes flying. I love it. It gets nice and clean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd heard that there's some danger of overspinning your fans, and these are nice fans, aftermarket fans. So what I usually do is I kind of wedge a little toothpick in the grill to keep them from spinning while I blow them out. Well, yeah. So I bring it back in, I plug it in and turn it on, and usually the fans just sound terrible, like I've just really wrenched the guts out of them.
Oh, interesting.
But this time is even worse. I cleaned everything out like I always do, brought it back in, turned it on, and nothing happened. No post, no beep, no nothing. I got to the point where I took out every single peripheral, the CPU.
It sounds like you're not using canned air, the stuff that photographers use to clean lenses. Do you actually have an air compressor?
Yeah, you got me.
Oh my goodness.
I don't stick the nozzle right there and just explode it.
When you say blow it out, you really mean blow it out.
Yeah, that would be bad.
Wow.
No, I stand back a little bit to try to, give it just short load.
Yeah, I mean, I would recommend maybe using canned air instead of a compressor. I'm afraid that you're it's a little late now to tell you that. You're firing quite a stream in there. Now I understand why you're toothpicking your fans. Cause,
yeah.
So nothing will happen at all, huh?
Yeah, so I've upgraded now. I mean, it was sort of that was the silver lining. I have a nice new Core Duo system.
Yeah, usually when I want a new computer, I break the old one. That seems like a good excuse. Hey, it's not working anymore. I guess I got to get a new one.
Yeah, my wife is listening, so that's
I accidentally put the hose on instead of the compressed air, and I...
Wait a minute, I'm writing these down.
Yeah, these are all good excuses. I've used them all. I would say that it's likely, of course, the first thing to think about is the power supply. If you're not even getting anything, I mean, the fan's not spinning, you're not getting post tones.
It does, I'm sorry. I should say that the motherboard LED lights up.
Yeah.
The fans come on.
The fans do come on, okay.
It's just the motherboard doesn't beep.
It doesn't go past that.
Really
I think you probably knocked, here's a couple of things. If you knock the CPU loose or you break it, that's a symptom of a non-working CPU. In other words, if you take the CPU, the microprocessor out of the motherboard, the fans will come on, the light will light up, and nothing more will happen because there's no chip to do the post tones. There's nothing to think. So that's one possibility.
Shouldn't your motherboard beep at you and complain?
No, it can't.
Really?
It's got no sense in it. It's not got no brains. It doesn't know what's wrong.
I popped the CPU in another computer. It does work.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
And
could
RAM
be the socket.
Works.
Could be the socket got knocked loose. Could be a solder on the motherboard got broken off. Maybe it was a little fragile to begin with. You've obviously pulled it apart. You've checked all the connections. You made sure everything's. I would say you probably damaged the motherboard.
So the lesson here is just no.
I wouldn't use compressed air. No, a compressor is a little much.
You can use
canned air. It's not nearly as. I mean, you're putting a tornado in that thing. A canned air is just going to. And now the thing with canned air is do little puffs, because an extended time the air gets very, very, very cold. It'll freeze stuff. So just little puffs. That actually is a very good way to clean stuff out. But even with canned air, you can knock stuff loose and damage stuff. I think almost certainly what happened here is the socket, probably the socket, but something like the socket or near the socket or, some trace or wire got broken. If, for instance, the socket, a solder on the socket got broken, the chip would still work, but when the chip's in the motherboard, it doesn't know it's there. It's something like that.
So in the future, what can I do at least to protect the fans?
I wouldn't be using an air compressor.
Yeah.
How much power? What are we talking about PSI here?
I mean, I don't know.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Compressed air is not nearly as vigorous. I think just a little. I mean, a canned air. I think a little. Those little canned air you get photographers. Be careful. Keep them away from the kids. Those things are dangerous. The propellant and so forth. But a little canned air, blow it out. That's actually not a bad idea. They do get pretty dusty inside those things. And I wouldn't do it too often, more than once a year. It's like steam cleaning your engine. Yeah, it's nice. You get a nice clean engine. But how many problems does that end up causing? Well, frequently it does, doesn't it? You have to be careful with these power tools inside your hardware. Thanks for the call. I'm really glad you're listening and watching the show on the Ustream, David. More of your calls coming up. The phone number, 888-ASK-LEO. We're also going to talk about high-def DVDs with our home theater expert. You stay here. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And a very good day to you. Leo Laporte here. I am the tech guy. We talk about high tech every single week at this time on this station. And high tech doesn't just mean computers. Oh, heaven forfend. Oh, no. Far more than just computers and the internet. We got cell phones. We got camcorders. We got all sorts of stuff. In fact, a little later on, we're going to talk about home theater with Scott Wilkinson, video editor for the Perfect Vision magazine. He's going to talk about the future of HD DVD. You know, I think it's in a little bit of trouble because you're starting to see high-def streaming, other alternatives for watching high-def. There are now new services to get high-def movies. This Vudu service I talked about last week that will stream high-def over the internet to your TV. I think, you know, these high-def formats might be, this war hasn't been good for them, the Blu-ray versus HD DVD war, and it might be that it just slows them down enough that the online high def comes along a little faster. I don't think Scott agrees though. We'll talk about it in just a little bit. Some good news for folks who like to listen to music on the internet. Not necessarily even your favorite broadcast station, but any things like Pandora, Last.fm. Pandora's, have you tried Pandora? Pandora.com? What a neat way to discover new music. You tell it what you like, what kinds of artists. And it will create a radio station, high quality radio station, free. You stream from your internet to a computer or, you know, any device. And, you know, your stereo, if you have a way to hook it up to the internet. And you'll hear songs from artists you've already said I like, but you'll also hear songs from artists that are similar, genetically similar, which is kind of neat. I mean, I think this Pandora is wonderful. Record industry wants to put it and every other internet radio station out of business. In fact, the deadline was May 15th. The copyright board acceded to the record industry's demands to increase the royalties, and not only increase the royalties significantly, but to take away the ability of radio stations to pay a percentage of their revenue. That kept these stations alive. They don't make a lot of money. So if you can pay a percentage of your revenue, at least you know, hey, well, that's going to be the cost of playing this music. And if I don't make a lot of money, I don't have to pay a lot of money. But no, they're going to eliminate that. And then worse, they made it retroactive to the beginning of 2006. So on May 15th, all of these internet radio stations were expecting a very big bill. And it probably would be the day the music died, frankly. I mean, most of these stations would go out of business. I talked to the founder of Pandora, he said, well, we have enough cash to pay that bill, but I don't know how much longer we'd last beyond that. Well, the good news is the copyright board, I guess, NPR's complained about this. So many people complain about this that, in fact, there's a bill in Congress, the Internet Radio Equality Act, to overturn this ruling. So the copyright board, I guess they said, well, wait, maybe let's not rush here. And they've extended the deadline by a couple of months. So you got 70 days to debate this thing. And let's hope they manage to talk these guys out of it. Tim Westgren, the guy who runs Pandora, I asked him, I said, well, what, I don't understand. Why would the record companies want to put internet radio out of business? He said, I don't think they do. He said, I think they want more money from us. Because why not? They wish they could get more money from broadcast radio, but it's the horses left the barn on that. Let's get internet radio instead. They charge internet radio, for instance, performance fees. You know, a broadcast music station, radio station, pays license fees, of course, but they only pay it to the publisher. Internet radio pays these publisher fees and performance fees. Because the recording industry said, well, wait a minute, we may have messed up with broadcast. Let's get some more money out of these guys. And Tim believes that what happened is the record industry went to the copyright board and asked for the moon, never thinking they'd get it. They thought, well, we'll negotiate from there. You know, this is our high offer, and then we'll negotiate down. And they were kind of stunned. The copyright board said, okay, fine. And I don't think as interested in money as the music industry is, I don't think they really wanted to put internet radio out of business. Because now they get that, you know, if that happens, they get nothing. I think they wanted to squeeze them as hard as they could without putting them out of business. And I think, unfortunately, their first offer got accepted. And now really they're faced with the prospect of putting them out of business. So I'm sure there'll be some negotiation going on. And I do hope we can save net radio, because it's so great. It's a wonderful way to get, you know, new artists on the air, and for a lot of people who want to be in radio but can't get on a broadcast station to do their own thing. SaveNetRadio.org if you want to know more about that. And they've got a little countdown clock on there to July 15th now instead of May 15th. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Julie on the line from Chino, California. Hi, Julie. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Leo.
What can I do for you?
Can you hear me okay?
Oh, I hear you great.
Okay, thank you. Can I just tell you have the most soothing voice? I love your voice.
I hope I don't put you to sleep.
Oh, not at all.
That's why they don't put me on late night, because everybody would fall asleep. Thank you, Julie. That's nice of you.
Okay, this is really weird. Within the last week, on my husband's computer, oh my gosh, there's sirens going by. Sorry.
That's all right. Don't worry about it. I can't hear him.
Every time I click on the E to open up Internet Explorer, every single time I get the Microsoft Internet Explorer has encountered a problem and needs to close. We're sorry for the inconvenience.
Okay.
And it gives you the option of send error report, don't send error report.
Yeah, it crashed.
The computer?
No, well, the problem with Internet Explorer and the Windows is they're so tightly tied together. It's not like it's just an application that you could uninstall and reinstall, although that's probably what you need to do. What version of Windows are you using?
It's Windows 2000.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And the thing is, you know, I've been looking at this all last night and today, and it gives you a link, you know, to see more information.
Yeah, no, those things are all useless, believe me.
Really?
Yeah. There, I mean, I don't know why they even bother. You know, click here and we'll tell you more. Would you like to report this? None of that stuff does anything. Really what's happened is, in all likelihood, one of the files of Internet Explorer has become corrupted. Now, let me ask you a couple of questions.
Okay.
This is your husband's PC?
Yes.
Okay.
Mine's working great.
Yeah, of course yours is working fine. Does he have anti-spyware and antivirus software on there, and he keeps it up to date and all that stuff?
He has this AVG free edition.
Okay. How about anti-spyware?
That I don't know. Yeah. Is there a way to check that?
Yeah, well, you should see. I mean, look and see if there's one installed. I would get the one from Microsoft called Defender. It's free, Microsoft.com/spyware. Reason I ask is it's not unusual for spyware to modify Internet Explorer, and when it does,
okay,
it can make it worse, mess it up, or you can get spyware on your system and use a spyware removal tool, which will then kind of rip the heart out of Internet Explorer and it'll never start again. So one of those things might have happened. I mean, it could just be cosmic rays, and it sounds like a joke, but I'm not kidding. Just, you know, There's always subatomic particles bombarding everything all the time. And if one hits your hard drive in just the right way and flips a bit in just the right way, suddenly Internet Explorer doesn't launch. So these things happen, in other words. Another possibility, do you keep Windows up to date?
Yes.
So he runs Windows Update.
The automatic updates are turned on.
Good. Has he updated to Internet Explorer 7? Or is it IE6?
Is there a way to check that?
Well, the icon looks different. IE6 has a little kind of comet flying around the blue E. I mean, IE7, the new IE, the new Internet Explorer has a little comet flying around the blue E.
Okay, no.
Okay, so that's one thing you might want to do is go to Windows Update and install IE7.
IE7.
That's a big improvement, by the way, over Internet Explorer. And in the process, you might, in fact, very likely will fix Internet Explorer. Depends how, you know, what file's damaged. But you'll replace a good number of these files with IE7's files, and that may just fix it.
It's a file on my hard drive?
Yeah, that's what I suspect. I mean, that's hard for me to know exactly what's wrong, but often that's the case. There are a number Internet Explorer has a number of files, and if one of them gets slightly damaged, crash. Right? It can't start.
So I want to update it to IE7.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that will replace most of those files. It's like installing a new version of Internet Explorer. That may well fix it. Now, I can't promise it'll fix it because there's other things that could be wrong, but that's the first thing to try. And incidentally, that's a much more secure version of Internet Explorer. Yeah, quickly,
sure.
Okay,
so that's good. When I followed the links last night to the updates, it asked me to install Service Pack 4. Was that right that I did that?
Yeah, and is that when it failed?
No.
Oh, it was broken before.
One of the things I was
They're telling me
to
in the chat room, and I apologize. Internet Explorer 7 is not supported on Windows 2000. Microsoft, in their infinite genius, didn't update it. So I apologize. That will not fix it. So what you're going to instead want to do, and I'll put the instruction in the show notes here, is uninstall and then reinstall IE7. Or IE6, I'm sorry. And it's kind of the same thing, except you can't put IE7 on there. But there is a way to remove it. It's a command line thing to remove it and then to reinstall it. And it's the same idea. Let's see if these files are damaged. Let's reinstall them and see if it fixes it.
So I uninstall IE6?
Yeah, I'll give you. It's kind of complicated. I'm going to put it in the show notes.
Okay.
I'll give you a link to a Microsoft document that explains step by step how to do this.
So I go to the show notes.
Oh, but you can do it on your computer. That's right. I was going to say you can't do it. The other thing you could do is install Firefox. Does everything else work fine on that system?
Like as far as my documents and Excel and things like that.
Yeah, all that stuff's working?
It seems to be.
You could always install Firefox, which is probably a safer, better browser than IE6 anyway. How are you going to do this? Because you can't open your browser. You're going to have to put it on a USB key and move it over from your computer. GetFirefox.com. And I'll put in the show notes the fix instructions for you. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Can't believe it. I have to apologize to our last caller, Leo Laporte, the tech guy, taking your calls at 8888-ASK-LEO. Poor Julie, I told her to get two programs that don't work on Windows 2000. I've got to keep up on what Microsoft operating systems work with what Microsoft software. Neither Windows Defender nor IE7 are available for Windows 2000. That's primarily, in my opinion, primarily because Microsoft wants to move you off of Windows 2000 to Windows Vista. Well, I'll give you some justification for that belief. For one thing, the program that Microsoft bought, Giant Anti-Spyware, to make Windows Defender, did run on Windows 2000. Ran fine on Windows 2000. In fact, it ran fine on all versions of Windows. So it seems unlikely that there's something magic happened that made it suddenly not work on this older version of Windows. It's much more likely Microsoft just put a little switch in there and says, don't make it work on this because we don't want them to use it. You know, when you have a problem like Internet Explorer not working, it's a pretty significant issue because Internet Explorer is used more than just to surf the net. It's a key component in Windows anyway. So if you can't, you know, manage to, and I put in the show notes a link to the Microsoft document that talks about repairing it. But if you can't repair it, it's probably time to reinstall Windows 2000. Your husband will love that. Honey, I called and they said, you can fix it. Just reinstall your entire computer. I'm making friends. Everywhere I go. Mark Costa-Mesa, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Leo. I recently got into editing videos and I upload them to VidShadow. And I've got a nice program, but I'm trying to find a way to convert my digital files like slow motion. So when I upload them, they'll be in slow motion. Is there a way to do that?
Yeah, it just depends on the video editor that you're using.
Mine doesn't seem to have it. Is there something else I can? Is there any like?
You're saying you're using
something.
You're using something called what? VidShadow.
VidShadow is a place where I upload to. It's kind of
it's an online site. Oh, cool.
Yeah, I'm using
Windows
Magic,
Movie Maker. Oh, Magic
Pro. Okay. Edit 11.
Yeah, Magic's pretty good. It doesn't have a slow-mo feature, huh?
I can't find it anywhere. Huh. No. And it seems to do everything else.
Yeah, I'm really surprised.
Yeah.
Because that's frankly something that almost every video editor I've ever seen can do.
Okay, well.
You might want to do is, before you give up on Magic, I don't know, actually look at the manual or I don't know, something. Find an expert, go to the forums. It seems to me that it's something it should do, and it's probably, I tell you one thing, I know many editors hide it in such obscure locales that you'd never know. So it may just be that it's somewhere hidden away.
Okay.
If you want to get another editing program, I don't think, well, I guess you could. It's better to do it in the editor because then it's undoable. If you could, of course, download some program that would slow it down, but it would be modifying the clip, right?
Mm-hmm.
Permanently.
Yeah.
And, you could always make a copy, but I'll have to look and see if there's any little standalone utilities to slow things down. Most video editors do, and maybe a little better than Magic is Adobe's Premiere Elements, I think, is an excellent editor. That has built-in DVD burning and just a really great editor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's $79-$80. It's not hugely expensive. But let me see if I can find something for you, a little standalone utility that will take video. They're in AVI format?
It'll do anything.
What are you working in?
They're coming from my digital camera, so they're MOV files.
They're QuickTime movies?
To begin with.
Okay.
Yeah, so which is nice because in the QuickTime, the free QuickTime, I can slow them down to watch them. And they look great, but I don't have any way to do it.
I think if you pay $30 more for QuickTime Pro.
Oh, you could do that?
Yeah, it'll allow you to save them that way.
Well, that might be the cheapest way to go.
That probably is. Before you spend that money, let me check and make sure that you can. I do know you could slow it down. Let me make sure that you could save it. Generally, that's the difference between the free QuickTime and QuickTime Pro is things like the ability to save what you've done.
Well, the
like
free
that.
One, you know, when you do it, when you watch it on the free one, it ask you if you want to save it, and you can, but it seems to only save it to the replay. It doesn't convert the...
You don't have as many export capabilities in QuickTime as you do as in QuickTime Pro. In fact, you can even see them.
Right.
Yeah, I'm seeing here in the AV controls playback speed, and I guess what you'd like is a way to say, save it with that slower playback speed. And I'm going to, before you spend $30, I actually want to check and make sure that you can do that. I don't want to mislead you there, but that's a possibility.
Have you never heard of VidShadow?
It's like, no, YouTube. Tell me about it.
I guess I think it's a new company just starting up.
It's VidShadow, vidshadow.com.
Yeah, and they pay you money, actually. You get like I think a penny for every six people that visit your videos.
It's like Rever does that too. They share the revenue.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I think that's the future of these sites. In fact, there's even a rumor, I think even Google has said that they're going to do the same thing to YouTube at some point.
And then the VidShadow seems to have better video quality than YouTube.
Yeah, YouTube's is not great, is it?
No. But I have my own show on VidShadow.
Oh, what's the name of the show?
It's called Kayaking with Sandmarks. So that's, I upload my videos that I take when I'm out kayaking.
How fun.
So if you go to the top shows on VidShadow, it says top shows.
What kind of kayaking? You do ocean? River?
Ocean kayaking, yeah.
Oh, what fun.
Yeah, so I'm having a lot of fun and playing with this new editing program and trying to...
And what do you shoot your video with? You said your still camera, huh?
Yeah, it's a Pentax Optio W10.
Oh, yeah, because you can handle the water, can't you?
Right, exactly. And then, I'm really impressed with the video quality.
That's cool. Hey, I got to run. Thank you for the call. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We'll be right back.
the tech guy from the Tech Guy Labs in beautiful Silicon Valley. And look, lo and behold, who should join us? The great Scott Wilkinson. I love it when Scott's here because he explains all this home theater stuff clearly and succinctly and without a lot of, frankly, hype. And there is a lot of hype out there.
There's an awful lot of hype out there, no doubt about it.
One of the things a number of people have been talking about is the competition. We've talked about it between HD DVD and Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've been thinking of is these, you guys better work it out because consumers are going to wait. They're not going to buy. And pretty soon it's going to be too late anyway, because we'll be downloading high def video. I can already download high def video on my Xbox 360. It's only a matter of time before Apple and others start to offering it. Do you agree? Are the days of high def discs numbered?
Well, as with any technology, certainly the days are numbered. The question is, what is that number?
Right.
And I tend to think that high def discs, or what's sometimes called physical media, the days have many more numbers on them than a lot of people are saying.
Really?
A lot of people are saying HD DVD and Blu-ray, you know, this whole format war is moot because we're going to be downloading anyway, and so who cares?
Right.
Which one wins?
Right.
I tend to take the other approach. I tend to think that while this may very well be true for music,
Maybe standard or enhanced
and
definition,
maybe even standard definition, yeah, TV. Although even there, I do think that may be true. But for high definition, requires so much bandwidth,
right,
to download. I mean, if you've been downloading some high def, you know, during a review of one TV with some downloading capabilities, I went to Cinema to download an hour and a half long high def documentary on this. And as I started downloading the little thing on the screen, it took over 5 hours to download. And that was on a 3 megabit connection.
And that was optimistic because I've spent all night downloading high def movies from Xbox.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. You know, as long as most consumers have download speeds in the 3 to 5 to 6 megabit range,
right,
downloading high definition just takes so damn long.
Well, you need a big hard drive too, because each movie is like several gigabytes. And
that's exactly right. You need a huge hard drive to do that. Now, there are some things on the horizon to increase bandwidth. A Verizon Fios, for example.
Right.
I've got a friend who's in a target market for that, or an experimental market and the trial market, and they're doing 15 megabits.
Right.
Which
even
is great.
Cable companies are now starting to offer upwards of 15 to 20 megabits.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But in Asia, for example, that's common.
Right.
Most people get that kind of speed.
Let's say that happens in 5 years. I mean, that might, I mean, which I don't think is unrealistic. That might be the window of time that HD DVD or Blu-ray have to find an audience.
Yeah, but that's only one of the problems. Another of the problems is that video content is compressed to within an inch of its life for downloading. And so the picture quality is generally not as good.
Yeah.
Now with high def, I still when I downloaded some high def material, it looked pretty good, but not as good as Blu-ray or HD DVD. And looking at standard def material, I thought it just looked ugly. I was not real happy with what I have found in terms of downloading standard def material.
Because they're so heavily compressed.
They're so heavily compressed, exactly, in order to get the file sizes down to any kind of reasonable level.
I agree with you. In fact, I might not have noticed last year, but now that I'm kind of watching a lot of HD DVDs, mm-hmm, I suddenly can see the difference very clearly.
Exactly.
I'm not happy with it anymore.
Exactly. Then there's the issue of portability. Discs are easily portable as long as you have a player at one place or another. You can take them along. But DRM protected content, DRM digital rights management protected content.
Don't get me started. Not that the discs aren't protected, but at least you can carry them around. Anyway.
You can carry them around, yeah. Exactly. There's also the issue of longevity. What if your hard disk crashes?
Right.
You know, and how easy does DRM make it to back up,
right,
that downloaded content? Your content goes south with your hard disk. Those shiny discs are not going to crash.
Well, you make a good point, and it really is true that the disk format is particularly useful. Should people then bite the bullet now and buy an HD DVD or a Blu-ray player, or should they wait?
Well, that's a good question. I've just recently seen a few sales reports, and of course, each camp, Blu-ray is claiming victory.
Because of one movie. Just because of James Bond.
Yeah.
Casino Royale, which was actually the 100,000 seller.
Right. Blu-ray is claiming, I think they're coming up with close to a million titles, discs sold, or titles, I forget exactly what it was. And also they're claiming victory.
One-tenth of them with Casino Royale.
Exactly.
It's not a number that blows my mind yet.
No. And yet HD DVD promotion group the next day came out with a press release saying, yeah, we've sold almost a million copies too, so, you know, what's the big deal? PlayStation 3 is a pretty big, important consideration when you're talking about which one is winning, because a lot of people have PlayStation 3 and that can play Blu-ray.
Right.
With an Xbox 360, you need this HD DVD add-on player for an extra couple hundred bucks.
Right.
But then you've got HD DVD playback.
And not that many people have bought Blu-ray, bought PS3s yet. So, I mean,
I don't know what the numbers are there.
That's not a hit either at this
point. Yeah. Interesting. That's very interesting. Yeah. Now, LG, as we talked about before, has a combo player, which has some limitations. Samsung just announced a combo player as well that'll play both formats. It should be out by the holiday season this year. I'm chomping at the bit to get one to try. I really believe that's the best solution.
And that'll drive prices down as competition. Now there's competition.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, prices are already going down. Toshiba is down around $500. Sony has a new Blu-ray player out for about $600. So whereas Blu-ray players were at least 1,000 before, we're now getting them about half that, HD DVD has been for quite a while. So there's more competition there as well in terms of pricing of players. But I would hold out for a combo player myself.
I agree. I don't think the time is right yet.
Not quite.
Yeah. And I guess I'd have to agree with you. It's not right yet for downloads either. But I have to say that that's happening fast. Who knows how fast that'll happen?
Yeah, that's true. I think DVD is now about 10 years old, and it's fast approaching where it's going to get replaced by something.
Right.
And if we can have a Blu-ray and or HD DVD for 10 years, that's kind of the life cycle kind of number we're looking at, I'm looking at anyway. So plus the fact, if you're interested in quality, you're going to get it with a disc more than you are with downloading, at least for now.
I agree with you. And I tell you, it sure looks great. It really mm-hmm. does look, if you have a good TV, either Blu-ray or HD DVD, really do look good.
Absolutely. I agree.
Speaking of looking good, you can catch the good looking Scott Wilkinson. His work is in the Perfect Vision magazine, on newsstands everywhere, or download your copy for free from avguide.com. Scott's the video editor over there at Perfect Vision magazine. Joins us every week. Next week, we're going to talk about choosing your TV, your next HDTV, and where you start before you buy. That should be interesting. Thank you, Scott. We'll talk to you next time.
Looking forward to it. Thanks.
Thank you, Scott. Just looking at the people in the chat room about our previous caller, Mark in Costa Mesa. I don't know why I didn't think of this. Windows Movie Maker does slow-mo video. So if you're editing video on Windows, Windows Movie Maker, not my favorite program in the world, but at least you could create a slow-motion clip in it. And you've already got that. It's on every version or every recent copy of Windows in the last, say, 10 years. iMovie does it on the Mac if you're using a Mac. So that's how you do slow-mo. I'm looking for those kayaking videos, Mark. I want to see your kayak channel. Let's get back to the phones. And next on line one, Alex from Tucson, Arizona. Hello, Alex. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. I have a question about Outlook 2003.
Yes.
I have a bunch of rules that I've set up to sort my mail as it comes in. And about a month ago, they just stopped running automatically. And the thing is, I can still run them manually.
So they're still there.
They're still there, and they run when I first started up, but over the course of the day, they stop working.
So, that's odd. Did you modify your rules in any way?
No, not. They were working fine, and then just one day, they just stopped working. And I've tried deleting all the rules and remaking all of them, and that didn't help at all.
Huh. That's interesting. I wonder if there's a setting in Outlook 2003, a kind of a global setting that turns off automatic rules. Are your rules based on your... Did you change accounts? Did you change the email account?
No, I didn't change accounts to change anything.
Okay.
That's what's weird about it.
Huh. Because sometimes the rules are tied to specific POP accounts, and so if you had changed your account, that could make it not work. You got me. I'm not sure why they would all of a sudden stop working. My first thought, and I'm sure you've tried this, is there's somewhere in the settings that might have a kind of a global setting that says stop running the rules or don't run the rules automatically or that kind of thing. But you've looked at that, I presume.
Yeah.
I don't know. Let's open this up to our audience of Windows experts, Office experts. Why would Outlook 2003 suddenly stop running its rules? There's one, one thing. There is a limit. I don't think this is it. There's a physical limit to the size of the rules you can have. I think it's 32K per account. And that's one thing that did happen in Outlook 2003, I know, is that because they started using Unicode, that actually have the amount of space you have for your rules. Sometimes you're going to have too many rules. Let's look and see if we can find out. I'll check with the chat room. If you've got a suggestion, you can email Leo@techguylabs.com or call us at 888-ASK-LEO. We'll find an answer for you, Alex. Why would his rules, those message filters are so useful, so helpful, just, stop working? He can run them manually, but they don't run automatically. Maybe you've got a suggestion. I've been putting the show notes up on the website, by the way, and that's a place that, you can look again, Alex, later in the show or even later in the week. Maybe we'll find an answer there. That's at techguylabs.com, techguylabs.com. Chat room is a great place, too, to get extra help, and I know that's where I go to get extra help. They're about we're one short of 200 people. We have 199 people in there right now at irc.dslextreme.com. And so if you have a suggestion, that's the place. I'll have to think about that. Why would the rules stop working? It's a mystery, the kind of things Windows does all the time. Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy. The Tech Guy, geeking it up as we do every weekend on this fine radio station. 8888 Ask Leo is the number. I've been chatting in the chat room. We have a number of guys, including one of our chat mods, Mike B, who will work in support for IT, and they deal with these Outlook 2003 issues all the time. And he said, and this is very, very cool, there is in Outlook 2003, probably is in all versions of Outlook, you can run Outlook from the command line with various parameters, including one that says clean profile. So if you type outlook dot, click start run outlook.exe /, clean profile. And Mike says that often fixes some of these issues. He also says if you're on an Exchange server and your rules are not local to you, that could be part of the problem as well. I'm thinking that's probably not the case for Alex. But we'll keep figuring, seeing if we can find other reasons why suddenly your mail rules don't work. Those are so important. You don't want to be without those. I know that. Let's go to William in San Diego. William, welcome. Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy. Hey, William.
Hey, Leo. Hi. I was wondering what your position was on WildRider.
On WildRider?
Yeah, I know you play World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
And it's a really cool utility. I don't know if you've even used it.
I've been staying away from third-party utilities just because I'm afraid it will screw things up. So tell me what WildRider does.
Now, WildRider, what it actually does is you run WoW in a windowed mode, and you bring this up next to it, and you tell it to start marking waypoints.
Oh, I'd love to have something like that.
Yeah, your little hunting ground. And then you say, okay, I only want to attack gorillas.
Okay.
And then you hit Glide, and what it does is it runs your little guy around, and when it sees a gorilla, it targets it and runs through your standard attack mode.
Oh, so you don't actually have to, this is a good way of leveling up, is what you're saying.
Exactly. It takes all the mundane, repetitive stuff out of the game.
Somebody, I read a blog post describing World of Warcraft in text, and it was basically run, 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 kill something. Run, 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 run. There is a lot more running than I'd like. Now, I'm looking here that one of the issues with WoW Glider is that Blizzard wants to put them out of business.
Oh, exactly. And if they catch you using it, they not only ban the account that you're using it on, but they ban every single account that you're paying for with the same payment information.
Oh, isn't that nice?
Oh, it's, yeah.
Well, they're very clear about that, though. They don't like these third-party add-ons, and there's a good reason for that. Some people believe that this is cheating.
Exactly.
Well, do you use it?
How is that different than contracting with, like,
well, I think that's cheating too.
But there's a lot of these gold sites where you can go and spend $10 and get 100 gold.
I know that bugs me a lot. This is a very interesting thing that's cropped up with these online games. We're talking about World of Warcraft, which is an online game that's probably the most popular out there. Millions of people play it. In fact, at any given time when you get online, there are well over a million people online at the same time as you. And it's a imaginary fantasy world in which you can either fight other players or you can join with other players to fight monsters and, you know, build up a character and get stuff. And, you know, there's a whole business around here of people who will level you up for, you know, you pay them and they will take your character that you create and get it to level 60, or I suppose you go to level 70 these days. And as you said, you can go to what they call gold farmers who will. I guess what it is it's some poor sweatshop guy in a sweatshop who just plays World of Warcraft all day making money.
Yeah.
Making World of Warcraft gold.
This is leveling the playing field by giving me the means to do that without employing some poor guy minimum wage to
the
run
thing
my
is,
character.
I think they'd like to ban the gold farming as well, but it's a little more difficult to do so. I mean, how do you, I'm sure that they try to. The thing about these third-party enhancements on these games is they really can ruin the experience for people who aren't using them. And I think it's first of all, and we'll see. I mean, they filed for an injunction against this company. We'll see what happens in court. But I think it's well within Blizzard, the company that makes this program, well within their rights to say, you know, you can't use these artificial tools and enhancements. A big problem, a huge problem. Not so much in World of Warcraft, but in games, online games where, you know, one player is against another player is players who use cheats. So if you're in, Quake Online or one of these head-to-head combat games online and somebody's cheating, you can't win. In my opinion, if you're 13 years old, you're cheating. Seems like all the 13-year-olds have much better reflexes than I do. I haven't tried WoW Glider, and given what you say the risks are of using it, getting banned for life, I don't think I will be. I'm not sure I would defend their right to do this. I mean, it isn't it's not their environment. It's not their world. I think Blizzard has the right on its own servers to enforce these rules. Now, here's where I do think it's an interesting question. Others have tried to create World of Warcraft servers or other Blizzard servers and have been sued out of existence by Blizzard. Blizzard says, well, you know, we also, not only do we insist on these rules, but we also insist you use our servers. And in cases like that, you know, I think I wouldn't have a problem if you had a server where cheating was allowed. I think that wouldn't be such a bad thing. Have you used WoW Glider?
Yeah, I have. Actually, and I'll tell you one of the things that I think that's even if you don't take into account the gold farming aspect of it, you're paying to play the game a certain number of hours per month, and say you have to run back and forth from Mental Harbor to Loch Modan two or three times.
Oh, I agree.
If you can just glide that, you don't have to sit there and
see
the character.
It's the most boring part of World of Warcraft. In fact, it's the biggest flaw in World of Warcraft is all this time you spent moving around instead of playing.
But I think that's
it's up to them, though. I mean, it's their game. You're playing their game. You don't have to play their game. And I think when you play their game, you play by their rules, and if they say you can't use third-party enhancements, I think they have the right to do that. And I think they have a very, I mean, I think they make a good case. Look, we're trying to preserve an environment where everybody has a level playing field. I'd love to see them ban the gold farmers. I think that's a lot harder to do. Interesting question, though. I thank you for calling, William. Leo Laporte here. I am the tech guy. Leo Laporte here. I am the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the number if you want to talk high tech with me, and I'd love to talk with you right now. 8888-ASK-LEO. Ask a question about computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, home theater. Share a comment, a suggestion. Talk about an internet debate. Our last caller talked about World of Warcraft cheats. You know, I've been thinking about it because it isn't. It's a fascinating subject. If you create an online game, an online world, you want to keep people from cheating because that spoils the experience for people who don't cheat, right? But on the other hand, first of all, you can't permanently keep cheaters out. You do what you can. And there's always going to be some cheating. Maybe what you do is you make, why don't they do this? Make a server where anything goes. Use all the cheats and weird third-party programs and whatever you want. If you're going to do that, go and hang out in this server with everybody else who's cheating. But this server is for players who want to follow the rules. That's the problem. It's like Monopoly. You saw episode one of the new season of The Sopranos. Tony Soprano cheats at Monopoly. But they also play a different rule. They play that free parking, the kiddie rule, right? Which I play. It's not an official rule. And his brother-in-law didn't like it so much. He said, hey, if the Parker brothers took the time to write these rules, I think we ought to respect that and follow the rules. And some people have that position. These are the rules, you follow the rules. And and the point is that when you play a game, if you're a person who follows the rules, play with people who follow the rules. And if you're a person who cheats, play with people who cheat. But don't cross-pollinate. Because then it's no fun for anyone. Well, it's fun for the cheater, I guess, because he wins. You got there. A game doesn't work unless you agree upon the rules. That's the bottom line. Any game, you have to all agree on the rules and follow the rules. And if what you agree on is anything goes, fine, nothing wrong with that. I think I probably, if there were a server where I could use this WoW glider program to save me time traveling around, I'd probably use it. Sounds like a good idea. It's tempting anyway. I like the idea. Seems like it'd be a fun thing to do. Did you see what happened at the... This happens all the time. Hard drives or laptops get lost. They have personal information on them. This happens far too often. Just happened this week to the Transportation Security Administration. A controlled area at TSA headquarters. Hard drive gone missing containing Social Security numbers, bank data, and payroll information for 100,000 TSA employees. Oops, oopsie. Oops. TSA Administrator Kip Hawley sent a letter to employees yesterday apologizing for the lost data, promising to pay for 1 year of credit monitoring services. Free, absolutely free. We lose your data, we'll pay for the credit monitor. He says, TSA has no evidence that an unauthorized individual is using your information, but we thought you ought to know. Oopsie, we lost it. This happens far too often. And you know what's really sad is there are very good, easy, and free ways to encrypt data on your hard drives. I know a lot of people, individuals who are using things like TrueCrypt, great program, TrueCrypt.org. Absolutely free for Windows. It encrypts your data so that if you lose your computer or your hard drive, no one can get the data. Now, why isn't the... This is a division of the Homeland Security. Why isn't the TSA using something like that? Why aren't they encrypting this data? Last year, the Veterans Administration lost a laptop with information on 26 million military personnel. They did get the laptop back, and the FBI says, we don't think the data was copied. How do they know? They don't know. How do they know? They can't tell. I'd be angry, frankly, if I were a TSA employee, you know, and it just really underscores the need for government and industry to protect our data. You've got our data. You have an obligation to do. I mean, it's easy. It's built into Windows Vista. It's Ultimate Edition anyway. It's File Vault's built into Mac OS X. And if you don't have it, well, you can use TrueCrypt. For crying out loud. Hey, speaking of Vista, news comes out that Vista, there is one negative to Vista. If you're using a laptop, it drains your battery. Have you noticed that? Anybody using Windows Vista on a laptop? It turns out the interface is the culprit. Aero Glass, that, you know, that transparency, the beautiful. Apparently, that uses a lot of juice. When Aero's turned off, according to CNET, battery life is equal to or better than Windows XP systems, where you turn it on and battery life goes way down. They've done a lot in Vista to improve power usage, but I guess they missed that. They forgot about that one. Oops. Oops. I don't know. You probably heard this news story, and I don't know if it's true or not. It started in the Wall Street Journal this week. Microsoft and Yahoo considering a merger. A terrible idea. But I guess there are people at both companies who feel like Google's eating their lunch, and boy, we better get together and band together to compete with Google, because otherwise we're going to be in trouble. It's not the first time these rumors have flown around that Microsoft and Yahoo would consider a merger. Maybe not necessarily a merger, maybe just teaming up, some form of cooperation. The Journal's kind of backed off on its story, saying, oh, they were talking, but they're not anymore, but other sources like Reuters are saying they are talking, so I don't know if it's true or not. But if it is true, please don't do it. This is not the answer. These two corporate cultures are very different. Neither is particularly innovative. I think they just sink under their own weight. Microsoft shouldn't get bigger at this point. Bigger is the wrong direction. 8888 Ask Leo, did you see Spider-Man 3? I guess a lot of people did. Big weekend numbers for Spider-Man 3. Well, of course, you could have seen it, pirated versions of it a couple of days earlier. You didn't have to go to the movie theater. Didn't take very long. The BitTorrent trackers have copies of Spider-Man 3. Not very good copies. One is a recording in English with Chinese subtitles. Both of them look like maybe they've been shot in the theater somewhere at a sneak preview that's kind of blurry. Not such a good picture. These are in-theater recordings. They bring in camcorders and they record the screen. And I'm sure the movie industry say, oh, this is terrible. They're stealing from it. I don't think so. Do you think anybody will watch this low-quality copy of it and then not go to the people who download these... Are people who are such big fans, they can't wait two extra days. They've got to see this lousy copy before they pay their $9.50 to go see it in the theater. They're going to go see it in the theater maybe twice. I don't think these kinds of downloads really hurt movie sales or even DVD sales. They're going to go see the movie twice. They're going to buy the DVD. They'll buy the special edition with the plastic Spidey and the black uniform. This doesn't hurt sales. Unless there's one possibility. Unless you see the lousy copy online and you realize this is a lousy movie and you decide I'm not going to go see it. So really the only risk is if it's a terrible movie, then it is a bad idea. Then you don't want anybody to see it. Keep it under wraps. Dave Lake Forest, welcome. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Dave.
Hey, Leo. I'm doing great. I know
good.
You are, too.
Welcome.
Hey, you were talking earlier about the DVD/VHS recorders.
Right.
And I am considering getting rid of my DVR service that I have to my local cable company.
Yep.
And doing that instead. If I set that to record a show for me, just to record a series, you know, every week on, you know, Wednesday at 8, record, you know, the TV show blank,
uh-huh.
do I need to put in a new disc every time, or can it record on the same disc until the disc is full?
They will use the rewritables, so you can record over, just like you would on a TiVo or your current DVR. But you can also record onto permanent discs if you want to as well.
So you can stack it up and get a whole season on.
Yeah, it's up to you.
Discs.
Yep.
Very cool.
Yeah, I like these. I think this is actually a very good choice. As I said, I would read the reviews on Amazon.com before buying any particular model, because some of them have various negatives. But Panasonic, people really seem to like those a lot.
Great reason to really want to get the one with the VHS still, or to just go get something that's just...
I would only get the VHS if you have still VHS tapes you want to transfer over. Otherwise, no.
Family movies or something.
Yeah, you know? If you have stuff still on VHS, go. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Then
nothing retail purchase, of course. You know, that would be
no. Cool. Well, you know what? If you have retail purchase, you may have difficulties copying them anyway, because there is an analog copy protection technique called Macrovision that's used on a lot of commercial VHSs.
Really?
Yes.
Even older stuff.
Well, just you know, it seems to be hit or miss.
Hmm.
So it's sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But it's something to be aware of. It's not automatic. You'll be able to copy those. It's an analog copy protection technique. So, yeah, that could potentially be a problem. But if it is home movies or it's not copy protected movies, yeah, this is a great way to get those VHS transferred over. And then, as I said, you get a DVR out of it. Not a bad way to go. Hey, thanks for the call, Dave. I appreciate it. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. Chat room is open, irc.dslextreme.com. We also have a web page. And I'm taking the show notes because America's favorite sophomore has the weekend off. So be nice. Be kind. It's at techguylabs.com. More of your calls coming up. For the Oakland Warriors, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right. Go Warriors. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I'm sorry for our friends in Dallas. I apologize. Coming up in just a bit, Dickie D, our weekly Gizwiz, Mad's maddest writer with a great gadget for us. It's actually kind of a funny gadget. An alarm clock that walks. A walking, talking alarm clock. 8888-ASK-LEO is the number, 8888-ASK-LEO, and let's see, Deborah is on the line from Santa Clarita. Hello, Deborah, welcome. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
How are you?
I'm great, thanks. I have a 1.3 gigahertz AMD older machine.
Okay.
And I decided to play with the BIOS this morning, and I went in to have it boot from CD-ROM instead.
Okay.
And then there's second and third choice, and I don't know if I... set it to IDE 0 or what I did, but I'm getting nothing.
Now it won't boot anymore.
No,
okay.
And I would assume it would, at least the BIOS would show up on the screen.
You can't even get into BIOS?
No.
Oh, so you can't fix it.
Did my video card break at the same time?
Something bad happened. So what happens when you turn it on now?
When I turn it on, power supply comes on, I get the two CD-ROMs, the CD and the DVD one, they just keep flashing back and forth like they're trying to read.
But you don't see anything at all on the screen?
Nothing on my screen. So I turned the screen off. I turned it back on because I've been listening to you for years.
Oh, good.
And I get no input, no signal input.
What is the key that you hit to get into BIOS? Do you know? What?
Delete.
Have you tried tapping that even though you're not seeing anything on the screen?
Yes.
And nothing happens?
No, I
does it stop accessing the CDs when you do that?
I didn't pay attention.
You can't tell. Well, I'm just trying to figure out if it's something simple or not so simple wrong with the video, or if really something's gone awfully wrong with the machine, so It doesn't.
Yeah,
it's not even working at all.
About. I just fired it up. I'm hitting.
Yeah, hit the delete key just to see. I mean, it may be that you are going into BIOS. At which case, if that's the case, those CD lights will stop flashing because it'll say, "Oh, she's not booting." And if they stop flashing, then well, maybe then that means the screen's broke or the cable fell off or something. The other possibility, I think, given that it's an older machine, this might be a more likelihood. Is it just may be that your battery on your CMOS battery it was dead or dying?
No, it's new.
It's a new machine.
No, it's a new battery.
Oh, you put a new battery in. Oh, good.
Yeah,
all right.
I could afford that.
Yeah. Well, good. Okay, so it's a fresh battery. I wonder if you somehow zapped the BIOS somehow by just modifying it.
I have no
idea. Boy, that's weird. I mean, it could be completely coincidental. Of course, I always hear the extreme cases, the highly improbable things where the video card failed at exactly the moment you decided to boot indifferently. Otherwise, you know, you'd have just gone on and fixed it. So you've checked to make sure your video cables are plugged in properly and...
Yeah, I've rechecked. I shut it down. I pulled the video card out, put it back in. Just wanted to make sure everything was correct. If you set it to IDE1 and there's IDE2, those two, you know, channels in the back where you plug into, but are on the board. But what if you set it to accidentally to IDE0?
Well, it just wouldn't boot. It would say what it should do, no matter what you've set it for, is it should go through the initial boot up process where it sees all the hard drives. And it says reports back, okay, you've got this CD drive, this hard drive, whatever. And then it should say, I don't see an operating system.
Okay.
So you should
have
stuff on the
screen. I guess.
Yeah, you should have stuff on the screen, and it should just not boot because there's no operating system. Same thing as when you try to boot from a CD or a floppy and there's nothing in the drive, and it just says, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't see anything here. The fact that you're not seeing anything at all.
Nothing, not a zip.
Well, yeah, you got to figure out why you were right to try to turn the screen off and on. You got to figure out why. You might try another screen, another cable, just try to narrow it down. I'm pretty sure it's not because you set the boot drive to something else. That shouldn't make any difference. It just should not boot. You know, if it's a non-existent drive, it's possible. Pop out the CD. Make sure there's nothing in the CD-ROM. I mean, it's possible that it is booting to something else, although you should still see all of that startup before anything happens. That's the first thing that happens. I'm puzzled. I'm not sure exactly what's going on there. You definitely replace the battery. You might want to try to go back to scratch, pull the battery, let it drain a little bit. If there's a jumper you need to set to drain the CMOS, do that. So essentially what that's doing is putting the CMOS back to the way it comes from the factory, which won't be optimal. But it might fix this issue. It's possible that besides changing the boot, you accidentally changed a video setting or something like that. But I think since since you were playing with CMOS, playing with the BIOS setup, let's look at that first. Pull that battery. If there's a jumper on your motherboard you need to set to drain the CMOS, set that. Let it sit for a while. What you're really doing is a hard reset on the CMOS, getting it back to the default sets. Then flip that jumper back, put the battery back in, try booting up then. And meanwhile, while you're waiting, you might want to check the cable, check the monitor, make sure all of that stuff's okay. Could just be that's sometimes when these things happen, it's just a bad combination of things, a coincidence, a bad coincidence. That's all I can think of. Deborah, good luck. Getting a lot of suggestions from the chat room, all of which are more of this kind of, you know, reset the BIOS thing. 8888 Ask Leo is the number coming up. The weekly Gizwiz, Dick DiBartolo, with an alarm clock that walks. You stay right here.
Find yourself in love.
From the Tech Guy Labs in Northern California, up here in beautiful Petaluma, I am Leo LaPorte, the Tech Guy, and he's back with our weekly gadget, the weekly gizwiz, we call it, Mad's Maddest Writer, Dick DiBartolo. I've been reading him in Mad Magazine for years, ever since I was a little'un. Although you're not that much older than me, Dick, so you started pretty young.
Yeah, we figured it out. I'm an hour and 22 minutes older than you.
And that's mostly because of different time zones.
Different time zones.
Right.
Yeah, if we were in Texas, we're the same age.
Absolutely. Mad Magazine, the May Mad Magazine, what's your article this month?
Let's see.
Fundalini?
We're still in April, so it's still reasons you want to switch to Microsoft Vista.
Yes, okay, I remember right. that. Yep.
All right, our gadget of the day is very strange. Let me just push this little button here. This is invented by a girl who was at MIT Labs.
So she's a brilliant engineer, no doubt.
A brilliant engineer.
That's like the place.
Exactly. And my little guy is not cooperating with me. This one, it's called Clocky. And it's there. Clocky was being temperamental, and
it's an alarm clock.
Right, it's an alarm clock, Leo. But you may hear gears running. Okay, Clocky. All right, Clocky not only makes those weird sounds, but it runs away, so that you have to chase it. This is for the person who cannot get up, and they keep hitting the snooze alarm. Well, Clocky sounds the alarm and then jumps off your nightstand.
What?
It has wheels.
It literally gets
it
off
literally,
the nightstand?
And the instructions say, please don't put Clocky on a nightstand higher than 2 feet. But if you do put him on a nightstand and you want him to run away, make sure he has a clear shot at the end of the table, at the end of your nightstand, because he jumps off the table and starts running around the floor. And every time he goes off, his wheels go in different rotation, so you can't find him.
Does he end up in a corner, or does he keep going?
When I did it in the bedroom, he ran around my bedroom and then got caught under the fringe of a rug.
That could be a little weird.
Yeah, well, it's very strange. It's very strange.
And yet, at the same time, what a good way to wake up with a laugh.
With a laugh.
You can't help but laugh. This thing, so it goes off like that, and then if you try to grab it, does it jump? I mean, does it jump right away? What is it?
Well, it gives you about 8 seconds of wake-up time, that normal buzzer that you hear.
Okay.
And then if you don't wake up right away, it goes into the
R2-D2 mode.
Exactly. And I find now that when this goes off, robots from neighbors miles away.
It's calling to them.
I went to work and there were four robots in front of my door saying, can Clocky come out and play?
The Furbies all come to play.
Yeah, but it's $50. It's very cleverly worked out. You can even set if you want the
snooze
alarm.
So she's selling
along.
This. This isn't some project at a graduate
lab. It took her like a year to develop it. She had to go overseas, work with engineers, make a timing mechanism that could stand the shock of Clocky jumping off a 2-foot table every day.
Yeah, no kidding.
And running around the floor.
It comes in. I'm looking at the website, which is NANDA Home, nandahome.com. And it comes in almond white, aqua, and mint, and soon mustard orange. I don't know who would want that, but soon mustard orange.
Mustard orange.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's you know.
And can
I
you
mean,
turn off the wheels if it? If
yes.
If
you know you get, what? It's very funny because if you were setting it for someone, you know, you say what time you want to get up, what time, how long you want the snooze alarm to be, and do you want the wheels engaged or do you want the wheels off? So. If you want Clocky just to sit on a counter and be a normal alarm clock, there's a wheels off motion.
That is
but
the
I mean,
funniest
if you
thing.
Buy Clocky, I know. If you buy Clocky, you certainly want him running around your house.
Oh, I mean, what's the point of having a clock that can run if you take his wheels off?
Exactly.
$50 bucks is not a bad price. Nandahome.com, and that truly is a gadget, an alarm clock that runs away from you.
You hear it here on the Weekly Gizmos.
On the Weekly Gizmos.
We don't do the ordinary.
No. We do a podcast that is daily. So if you want to hear the daily Gizwiz, you go to twit.tv. And if you want to see all of Dick's stuff, you can go to his website, gizwiz.biz. That's where you'll play the What the Heck Is It contest for a chance to win a Mad magazine. And, of course, Dick also runs Mad's MySpace page because he's the eternal teenager at heart.
Yeah. Go there, MySpace, / World of Mad.
World of Mad.
Videos up there.
All right. That's cool. Hey, Dick, always a pleasure. We'll talk again on Monday on the Daily Gizwiz, and I'll see you next week on the Weekly Gizwiz.
I'll be here.
He spends so much time collecting, looking for, finding the weirdest stuff. Just weird stuff. I love him. Dick DiBartolo. Jesse on the line from Auburn, California. Hello, Jesse. Leo Laporte here. I'm the tech guy, and you're our next caller.
Hi, Leo. So great to talk to you. I'm a big fan. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course. Thanks for calling.
All right. So my question is, I've got a PC, and I'm moving the data to a new PC.
Uh-huh.
I have a RAID set up in my old PC, and I think I'm not good with the numbers, but it's a striped array. So I've got two drives that look like one big drive.
Yes, RAID.
I think that's RAID 0.
Yes.
Okay. And my question is, I've got a bunch of data on that drive, or on those drives. I want to move them to the new computer, and I'm going to have a RAID 0, same type of setup in my new computer using the same hard drives. And I'm just concerned that I've never used RAID before, and if I take those two drives out and put them in the new computer...
That won't work.
It won't work?
Oh, I see. You're just going to keep the drives. You don't have new drives. You want to take those drives over.
Right. They're fairly new drives. The reason I'm getting a new computer is really the rest of the stuff in that computer is old. It's an old motherboard and it's an old processor and everything.
It might work, but it would require that the RAID controller, the RAID software, the RAID BIOS in the new computer is identical to the old. And chances are it's not.
That's right. It's not. So a new, different brand of motherboard.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to recognize the RAID array from the old computer. I've never tried this, but I'd be surprised if it does. The reason is these RAIDs, RAID on motherboard RAID is really a software RAID. It's done mostly in BIOS and in software.
Right.
And so essentially what we're saying is it's a different driver, different software. I think it's not going to recognize the array. I mean, you could try it. Now, I think it would be safe to take them out, put them in and try it and see if it sees the array. But if it says, I want to build an array, or if it doesn't see the data, stop.
Gotcha.
Because you'll lose your data. This would be a good chance to back up everything before you do this.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. Okay.
That answers my question, Leo,
and I just wanted to know if I could ask one other quick thing.
Certainly. Go right ahead.
Maybe you can comment on it when I'm off, you know, later. But I was just wondering, this is your opinion on, you know, when the whole tragedy happened at Virginia Tech and folks jumped on the video game bandwagon.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, particularly this, I think his name is Jack Thompson.
He's a nightmare. In fact, I hesitate saying that because he's so litigious. But this guy is, he's right now the attack dog on violent video games. And frankly, he's discrediting what I think is a perfectly reasonable position that violent games and violent movies desensitize us. I don't think that that's an untenable position. But boy, people like Jack Thompson make it look extremist.
Mm-hmm.
He went to court, and you know, there's, by the way, no evidence that this guy had seen a violent video game in his life. He didn't have any video games in his room. As far as we know, he didn't play video games. So, but even so, millions and millions of people play extremely violent video games and don't harm a fly. So I don't think you can establish a causal relationship between violent video games and violence.
Thank you, Leo. I just wanted to get your opinion on it.
Yeah, I don't think there's any evidence of that at all. In fact, I think there's pretty good evidence to the contrary. It's circumstantial evidence, but in fact, and this was a study that came out of the U.S. government last year, violent crime among youths has been going down ever since video game use has been going up. It has been going down. Now, again, I don't want to make a false logical connection. As they say, just because the two are connected in time doesn't mean they're actually causal. But it's as much evidence as anybody else has. Everything's a guess. And I think my best guess is it doesn't make people violent. it may be if you're a violent person, you are perhaps attracted to violent images and violent movies and violent video games. That's not what we're saying. It may well be that violent people use these, may even, you know, take a perverse pleasure in them, but the games themselves don't make people violent. I don't think so. Now, you can make it. It's too bad that Jack Thompson's around, because he really does make this an extremist position. You could take the completely reasonable position, and I think I probably do agree with this, that seeing a lot of violence on screen, in fact, I think it's worse in movies and TV where it's real people and vivid, realistic-looking violence, desensitizes you to the notion of violence. You get used to the idea of violence, which isn't a good thing. Doesn't mean you're going to commit violence, but maybe you have a higher tolerance of violence. Thing is, video games aren't that realistic. I mean, they're pretty clearly fake. So if you wanted to blame something for violence in society, I think a game is not what you would blame. You might want to blame the number. I mean, at primetime television, there's hundreds of deaths an evening. You might want to look at TV and movies. But even then, I don't think it causes people to be violent. I think the worst you can say is it makes them used to the notion of violence, which is not in and of itself good, but not doesn't cause things like this. You could describe a lot of causes. You know, when horrible things happen, like Virginia Tech, we all want to blame something or somebody. We want to say, frankly, I think it's a way of making ourselves feel better. Couldn't happen here because we don't have the same situation. Or maybe there's something we can do so this won't happen again. Because these things are so horrible, just so awful. You just want to say, there's got to be something we can do. And I don't think there is. Unfortunately, if there is, it's not banning violent video games. I go back and forth on this, and I let my kid play some games that are violent. Most video games are violent to some degree or another. I keep him away from some of the most egregious stuff like Grand Theft Auto, but he enjoys it, and he's not a violent kid, and he knows the difference. He really does, and I think most kids do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls coming up. 8888. Ask Leo. Play the good stuff before the show. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Just a few more minutes to go, but don't worry, there's always another show. Every weekend on this station, we talk about high tech. There's some topics that just continue on and on, and there's some topics that are new. That's the fun thing about this. There's always new stuff to talk about. But this violence in video games, this has been a topic of conversation since practically video games began. Certainly since Doom, which was the first really violent and somewhat realistic video game. But the interesting fact is that teen violence has gone down. Violence among teens has gone down since violent video games have come out. So I guess somebody could make the case. Well, no, they're less violent because they get their aggressions out in the game. They don't need to get it. I think every parent has to make this decision for himself. I know what my limit is, and actually my limit is higher than my wife. If it were up to her, she wouldn't let Henry, our 12-year-old, play any video games except, you know, racing games, unless they're crashes. Yeah, see, she wouldn't want that. Or, Mario. But, you know, he likes shooters. And so, you know, we worked out a compromise. He does it when she's not home. Kurt, Los Angeles, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Kurt. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Hi. I want to ask, I'm going to be getting a laptop here in the next few weeks, and I'm debating between a HP, a Toshiba, and a Fujitsu, and I was wondering your opinion on that.
Of the three, I prefer Fujitsu. I think they have the nicest screens. I like Fujitsu's a lot. HP's gotten pretty good. I think a lot of their laptops are pretty good. Toshiba, which used to be the dominant brand, the best brand, and the one I recommended for years, I think has gone downhill a little bit lately.
Okay. So Fujitsu is just a little bit more. Are you paying for better qualities or just the outside and the looks?
You're paying for the looks. They do have better screens. If you compare screen to screen, generally the Fujitsu screens are crisper and brighter and somewhat bigger.
So, but the insides are pretty much the same.
Yeah, you know, a PC is a PC.
Even though it's made in Japan? no big difference.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the components they're using are the same. I have to say that there is a difference among laptops more so than there is among desktops. A laptop, you have this limited real estate. So every manufacturer is really kind of doing their own custom design, right? There's no standardized laptop. And making different decisions about cooling, about, you know, keyboard real estate, about screens. And so in aggregate, those decisions do really make a difference. So that's why I would play with all three and really get a sense of it. Is one more reliable than the other? No, I don't think so. It's really, but they do use different components. They do make different decisions about where to put, you know, simple things even, like where to put the arrow keys on the keyboard. Okay. And that can make a difference. You really do want to, if you can, try the keyboard. And make sure you like it. I like Dell too, but the disadvantage of Dell is it's because it's mail order. You can't really try before you buy. But they make very high quality stuff.
They are, okay.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Not to add to your list, but there's another one.
Right, that's good.
And the negative on HP, frankly, is that they put a lot of junk on there. I mean, I think that's the real problem with a lot of PC manufacturers, and HP is among the worst, is all the stuff they put on the computer, all the trial offers, all the freebies, all of that stuff. There's actually a program called the Decrapifier. excuse my salty language, but that's what it's called. That you run, it will remove all the free junk that the manufacturer put on there. Really, those are just ads. You know, America Online pays them to include all this stuff. Net Zero and Earthlink pay them because they're hoping you'll sign up. The original Decrapifier was for Dells. I think it's become more generalized now to other computers. It won't get rid of everything, but it has a long list of with checkboxes of all the possibles that you could have on there. And when you check it, it'll uninstall it for you. It's kind of a nice idea. PCDECRAPIFIER.com. PC Decrapifier. I think it's a great idea. I really do. I think it's free. Let me just check here. It looks like they have. You can donate for $5, and then you'll get a subscription. It gives you access to the new releases. As you might imagine, this stuff has to be updated all the time. And if you're using it as a, you know, as a tool in an office or a business, then you have to buy the technician license for $20. But I think well worth it to get rid of that stuff. And in a way, if you think about it, this guy's got to spend a lot of energy updating it and fixing it to make it work for all the new systems. So, yeah, maybe you want to download that once you get that new laptop. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. We can't have run out of calls. Looks like we've run out of calls. Well, I want to encourage you to visit the website and the show notes, which I'm still working on, and it's going to take me a while to finish them all. But that's at techguylabs.com. And I will put in there any additional thoughts after the fact, because a lot of times I'll get email.
Yeah.
People have fixes and so forth that we get later. And I'll put those in the show notes. That's techguylabs.com. And that's where everything lives. Let me think. What else can I mention? The Twit Network. Kathy, what line is Kathy on?
Three.
All right. I'm sorry. I missed you, Kathy. Hi, Kathy. Welcome.
I almost had a heart attack. I thought you were good.
It's not showing up. I think something happened. I'm here. I think something happened to my screen. I'm sorry. My apologies.
I need a decrapifier. I can tell you that.
Uh-oh. What?
I got a Hewlett Packard. And I called you, I don't know, a couple, 3 months ago. I was the lady had a really weird problem that had a little virus.
Yeah.
Slowly destroyed my computer. Then he appeared himself before this evil.
Oh, grin. I remember that.
Remember that? Yeah.
Whatever happened? Now we only have about a minute. So whatever happened to that?
Well, I took it in to get it fixed, and the place that I took it to was even weirder than the problem that I had.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Kathy. This is an.
It's possessed, I think. So this here's my problem, real quick. So you know, I won't take up your time. They gave it back to me, sort of like halfway fixed. The problem now is D drive turned into M drive, okay?
Oh, dear.
And it sticks once you put your CD in there to put in something, you know, whatever.
Let me, you know what, I'm going to put you on hold. Hang on, because we do have to go, unfortunately. But hang on, and I'll take you right after we get into the break here so I can help you with this one. I will be back next time, though, and I hope you'll come back and join me. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Have a great tech day. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to hear the show live, check your local listings or visit our website, leo.am, for a list of stations where you can hear the Tech Guy radio show live on the air. You can also hear archived shows at leo.am and subscribe to our podcast there, or open your podcasting client and subscribe to the feed at leo.am/podcasts/KFI. Thanks to Howard Bailey for the music for this podcast. You can find more of Howard's work at soundclick.com. Thanks to Premier Radio Networks for syndicating the show. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. This is Leo Laporte. I'll see you next time on The Tech Guy.